This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series.
Hi folks, I think everybody is back from their drinks now, so let's get started again on the last bit of the night. Tom, I wanted to start with you. Obviously you've got me completely terrified, but I don't understand. What the heck is it about spiders? They're small, like you say, they're vulnerable. We can stamp on them. Why are we so terrified of them?
I think it's because they're so other. They're just very different to anything that we can really relate to. The movement is weird, the amount of eyes, the fact that some can kill you is also sort of probably up there. We have an Australian gentleman who was quite happy. I'm sure Richie will show the scarf to anyone who asks. It's on his arm, before you just want to say that. Just clarify that. For me, I think it's the sudden movements. It's just the fact that they can suddenly move very quickly in a very unnatural, well, seemingly unnatural. Of course, they are natural. They're animals on this planet. But yeah, so I think that's really the thrust of it.
Yeah, I lived in Melbourne for 2 years. You don't have to tell me about deadly things in Australia. One of the reasons I lived in Melbourne is that there weren't that many spiders there compared to other parts of the country. But you're writing horror there. That's obviously your thing. And one of the things I find hardest about horror is stopping people laughing at it. That you've got this whole Lovecraft thing of you're trying to make it seem the most horrible thing in the world, and your language just runs away from you, and people say the oddest things. How do you manage to cope with that, to try and make it sound like your characters are afraid without making them sound silly?
I think in some ways I do embrace the comedy. I think, you know, comic horror is a well-known, successful genre, and I think that there is humour to be had, and you have to acknowledge those parts. I think for me the best horror is when you can relate to it. And so I think with the character, very dismissive at first, and this is stupid, this is silly, this is ridiculous, rationalise, until you can't. And that's very much an M.R. James reference. That's very much his influence. All of his stories were the academic who didn't believe in the supernatural and would just sort of dismiss it out of hand, and it'd be very distant. And then it just creep into the story more and more before you just can't deny this ain't right. And that's what I try and do, and especially with the spider story. It starts off with one spider. Oh, okay, that's a coincidence. Oh, there's a lot of little spiders. Oh, that's a bit annoying, but yeah, actually quite scary. And then it's like, by the end, it's like, okay, wait, this is more than anything conceivable. And just trying to keep sort of like, well, how would I react in that situation? And keeping the character real, keeping the character true, and having a realistic response so that the reader goes, yeah, that's what happened to me. That's where the fear comes. It's just like, by putting the reader and the protagonist in the same place.
Of course, when you realise that it's all true, the next thing that you do is load up with as many big guns as you can possibly find and go and have a game of kill the cultists. But Anansi is real. Anansi is doubtless in this room at this very moment. That's one of the things about spiders, is that pretty much any room you're in, there's one of them there somewhere. Yes. Which, you know, that works as well. That's quite creepy. Lucy, moving on to you. That's the second book in your series. The first book is already out in the shops. So for the benefit of everybody here and the people who are going to be listening to the podcast, can you tell us a little bit about the first book and why they should go out and buy it?
I am the last person to ask when it comes to what is your book about. We're hopeless. The first book is completely different to the thing I just read. but it's still epic fantasy. It's about a 17-year-old girl called Kindra Vale, who discovers that she has some very interesting abilities, or she's a very interesting person, and has a very kind of traumatic coming-of-age ceremony, and ends up kind of going on the run from her own town with two enigmatic strangers wielding powers not seen for an age, as my publisher likes to put it. Really glad they're not here right now. And most of the rest of the book is set in a subterranean citadel where they have lots of exciting fantasy adventures. The thing is I can't say too much about the ending, because actually I can't say much about book two really, because it's a huge spoiler for the ending of book one.
I'm pleased to see that they connect up a little bit, because I always thought the thing with epic fantasy was that you wrote one book and then you wrote another one, and then you wrote book 275 of your trilogy set in the same world with the same characters, because your readers were continuing to clamour for more.
Yeah, well, book two, it does continue Kindra's story. She is still the main character. It's a trilogy. But I thought it's a lot more ambitious. I don't know whether this has worked yet, because you've only seen a tiny snatch of it, and I've been a bit nervous about the whole thing. But book two it's got five different point of view characters, three of whom are set in completely different locations, and two of those stories do end up converging. So Char does end up meeting Kindra. Yeah, I won't say any more about that. And he's an interesting character. And then the rest of the other major plot thread is with another two characters who you've met in book one. So there is a lot of book one characters. They're still very much part of the story. I just thought it'd be fun to have a few more characters to shake it up a bit.
So we got two very different readers here. Tom, you're writing horror short fiction, and Lucy, you're writing epic fantasy trilogies. Would you both like to say a little bit about why you settled into that form? I mean, is it the natural thing for you to do, or did it come and jump on you, or did you think it was a market, or what?
Well, with horror shorts, it's within Bristol, there's just a lot of great spoken word events, including this one. Where, of course, I'd mentioned this one and my own, which is on the 14th of December. It came out of those really, and just sort of going along to these events and just seeing these incredible writers and just sort of saying, I want to write something to perform. And then just writing a few more, getting them well received, and then going, actually, I could probably put all of these into a book. I would love to write novels in the future, and I definitely have a few ideas percolating, which I keep very close to my chest. But it's just the immediate feedback. You know, I can write something, go and read and perform it, and see how it does with an audience. And I think it's very easy to do that piecemeal with short stories than to do excerpts.
Yeah, so totally the opposite here. I was just talking earlier, Tom, about how I'm really hopeless at short stories. I think that's an art to be able to craft a successful short story. I came to fantasy from a very early age. I've always loved fantasy, and my dad used to read to us a lot. And kind of from the age of about 15, when I wrote my first novel, like most normal teenagers, I was a massive loner, obviously, and spent a lot of time writing a novel that was very much like a mashup of Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter. So it had Dark Lord, dwarves, elves, a rampaging army. It's kind of like a tick box of kind of all fantasy. But it was crap, but it made me really want to do, writing as a, and particularly fantasy, because for me, writing and fantasy are kind of intertwined. So I get a lot of questions like, oh, would you write a normal book? I'm sorry, but what's normal? The answer is probably not, because for me, fantasy and dragons and magic is totally normal. It's the world I live in. And I actually find it quite a lot easier to approach than short stories. I like the idea of doing the groundwork, like crafting a world, crafting characters and setting them up against, huge stakes.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I wrote comedy plays, but they were crap too. it occurred to me listening to you both that we've actually got through an entire evening of Bristol Confringe without killing anyone, which I suspect might be something of a record. It does, however, remind me that our very own Jo Hall here has apparently been voted Queen of Grimdark. Jo, tell us all about it.
Yes, I entered a competition that was probably about 6 months ago. Grimdark magazine were having a competition which they called a battle off, and it was to find the best small press or self-published fantasy battle, and I entered, and the first stages were judged. It was a public vote, so I squeaked into the top seven, and the top seven went on to be judged by professional judges, and I then promptly forgot all about it until last week when I had an email when I was on holiday saying, congratulations, you've won a whole pile of stuff. So which was nice. But it was very, very nice after being told by several people that girls can't write grimdark. It was very nice to actually win it and prove that sometimes they can.
And believe me, folks, if you haven't read The Art of Forgetting Rider, it's full of stuff from like medieval warfare about how they capture cities and stuff like that. It is really, really full of dead people. Alrighty. So, Justin isn't here this evening, so I'm hoping that somebody else is going to come up with a question that they can ask one of our readers. Anybody going to be brave and volunteer themselves? Jonathan.
Hello, Tom. The Anansi story. It was an interesting decision to write it in the first person, when traditionally something really horrible happens to the protagonist. Then it's in the third person, so you can go... So you don't have the, and then, dear reader, I died horribly problem. Why did you decide to do it in the first person?
That is a brilliant question, because originally it was in the third person, and then it was through the edit that I changed it. With this particular story, I wanted it to really resonate with the reader. Specifically, you know, I think it sort of picked up tonight. It was written for performance, it was written for these sort of storytelling events, and I really like getting the feedback of people going, oh, I just totally resonated with that character. So I thought, if I do it in the first person, when people are reading it, sort of the audience that I currently have is going to completely resonate with that character. And it was a way of keeping it genderless, because with the stories I'm writing, I'm trying to keep that disparity of male and female throughout. And originally, and it was a terrible mistake, of just having the writer and they and there all the way through, and it just really bugged me. But I didn't want to assign a gender to the writer, this person. So I thought, well, if I do it in the first, then... And also, you don't expect such a horrible ending when it's a first person. So it's that nice twist of, it can't go that way, but it does go that way. So it made the ending far more effective. And that's not my phone, so I just want to say that for the podcast. But yeah, so it was a conscious decision to keep the character gender neutral and to make the ending more of a twist.
Any other questions? Yeah.
It's for Tom again. Do you die in the end?
Originally, yes, I would say that was the death, but I like the ambiguity at the moment of just, it could be horribly, horribly disfigured. And just, just sort of, there's a way of just like, if they survived, they're not quite the same. So, take your way. Originally, they didn't, and then just now, just having Cheryl saying, oh, no one died in those stories, and me thinking, actually, did they not? Actually, if they didn't die, that's even better. I love what kind of thing they would be remaining afterwards. So now I've changed my mind, and now they're horribly deformed. So thank you, Cheryl. Thank you for planting that seed. But yeah, I love ambiguous endings where it's just like, make your own decision.
Are they just coughing up spiders for the next 6 months everywhere they go? Just like, so what?
It's beginning to remind me of Kenshin and the cochineal beetles. Yes. Which was really horrible. Oh dear. Okay, do we have any more questions? Jonathan?
Yeah, I kind of like the idea, just as a side comment, that further down the line, the narrator is going to grow himself a big beard and do meetings where he talks about announcing to people because he's seen the truth. But actually, the other question's for Lucy, which is, again, it's a contextual thing. There's mention made of sand dogs and what? And what are the other creatures?
Oh, Misha.
Yeah. Nobody can hear you until you have the microphone.
Yes, there's mention of sand dogs and...
Misha.
And they are...
They are the sand dogs, that's what they're called.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's the name for them in the language of the desert people or whoever it was. As we have mention of the grim dark thing, there is now this divide in fantasy, Lucy, between your George Martin, Joe Abercrombie, Joe Hall type stuff, where... millions of people die horribly, and the more traditional Tolkien type stuff, which is a slower and gentler thing, although large numbers of orcs appear to die in the movies. So which sort do you prefer and why?
I like a bit of Abercrombie, but I've only read his Shattered Sea trilogy, which is not that grim. Where I fall with my own writing is, okay, in Heartland there is a spine-pulling moment where a spine comes out in a horrible rush of gore, but that's about it. So, yeah, sorry to spoil that. Yeah, it's a bit dark in the book one, but actually I try to get into, I hope I was going to say, Mark Lawrence isn't here. I tried to get into Prince of Thorns, and I'm just sorry, but it's gratuitous, and I just can't really cope with that level of gore on page one of a book. So I probably prefer to read a kind of Jen Williams fantasy, which is, I just love her books because they're so, she revisits some brilliant, the tropes that made fantasy great, and she kind of puts a wonderful like 21st century spin on them. Copper Promise, if you haven't read it, it's just wonderful. But I kind of tend to prefer fantasy with has a kind of lighter feel to it. Not that it's, you know, you don't, it's not graphic at all, but I think something Grimdark's kind of had its heyday, really. It's still great, but I don't think it's... I think it's important that people like Jen and people like Rebecca Levine as well, who are writing books that are not like classically considered grimdark. Yeah, that's kind of where I fall with my own writing, really, as well.
No torture. No, I was just going to second that about Jen Williams, that if you haven't read the Gobber Cat books, they are awesome, and you really should, and they are so much fun. And they are just, you know, yeah, they're really everything that I like in a fantasy book. They are awesome. So I would second Lucy's recommendation.
All right. And for anybody who prefers their dark world and truly grim, you can always read Cameron Hurley's Mirror Empire, which destroys entire worlds. So why not? Now, I have a rather meta question for Tom. This whole thing about Anansi being the god of stories and stories are becoming more powerful in the world. I just had this sneaking suspicion you were going to go all political on us at one point rather than veer off into the horror and the spiders, because stories are becoming more popular, it appears, particularly in our culture, that we're seeing more and more people wanting to be writers, writing their own fiction and so on. But is Anansi becoming more powerful?
Oh, absolutely. And it was very, very unsubtle in that story, but I don't care. But I think, you know, sort of with the rise of ebooks and people reading on their phones and on their tablets, and certainly it's one of the reasons why I've stuck with short stories, is that people are looking for content. You know, you do find a lot of magazines now, you know, looking for short story content, and websites and with blogs. You know, there's the accessibility to stories is the greatest it's been. And I often sort of compare the Kindle to stories is what iTunes did for music, and how you suddenly had this great equalizer where anyone who had a musical instrument could load up a track and, you know, charge 79 pence for it. Now anyone can just, you know, sort of upload a Word document pretty much to the Kindle store and, you know, start selling their stories. And so there's this huge, you know, sort of variety. So it's very hard to find the good stuff. Thankfully, we're all in this room, so we can find each other. It's a great, exciting time because it's evolving. And we're seeing a lot of the publishing models, you know, changing, and how that's adapting. So, stories will never die, but the variety of voices and the number of voices is huge now, and it's only going to grow.
Any other questions for either of our readers? Yes.
Just talking about the evolution of stories, this is for Lucy, do you feel like you're taking up the gauntlet of traditional fantasy and doing something else with it?
Oh, you're so mean. Well, I think it's, whenever anyone asks me to describe my book, I end up kind of downplaying it by saying, oh, it's very traditional, because it is quite traditional fantasy. But I mean, I hope I've done a few new things. I was quite aware of a lot of like gender assumptions that people make about fantasy. So I wrote a fairly heated article about it, which was actually for Karen Miller's blog, but she advised me that it was a bad idea to publish it because I would upset some men. Completely true story, which now it's safely on my hard drive, upsetting nobody, but obviously challenging nobody either. But it's I loved fantasy. Was kind of, it really saved me when I was, you know, a lonely teenager having problems, and I spent most of my time reading Dragonlance in the library, and that's probably why I am like I am now. So maybe it's not a good thing, but I thought it was a good thing, and I've made a career out of it, and I felt like I wanted to stay true to some of those the tenets and the tropes, you know, and the characters that really helped me kind of through some, you know, interesting years and kind of made me decide to kind of be a fantasy writer. So I feel like, yeah, I am hoping to do something a bit new. But that's why I like Jen Williams, because she stays true to the kind of core tenets of fantasy while also exploring issues like homosexuality, gender, any kind of like stuff that's usually not tends to be kind of explored in you know, traditional Tolkienian kind of fantasy. Races as well. Not, and it's not all about race now as well. It's kind of actually just a bit more, you know, as in elves, dwarves. Yes, you find a lot of fantasy written today is mostly just about human interaction, which is quite refreshing really, because I think we've had a lot of Terry Brooks. I love Shannara.
There's nothing wrong with upsetting a few men every now and then. Made a career out of it. Yeah, I'm sure you can find lots of other people who would love to publish it if you don't want to. Claire?
Well, actually, on that note, for anyone who's not going to be offended, can we give you our email addresses so that you can send it to us? Just, I'd like to read that.
I'd like to read it too.
Yes. Yeah, well, we all want to read it now. Well, possibly the men don't, I guess. Tom does. Yeah.
It's a bit wild, so I think that's why I was a bit...
Yeah.
She said, oh, if you're at the start of your career, though, don't you want to be embracing everything?
No, there is a point to that, actually, that if you are at the start of your career, because when you do say these things, you can get some quite incredible pile-ons by people on the internet. So there is a certain amount of wisdom to not letting people have it with both barrels until you're actually in a position that you know you're going to get plenty of support from your friends. So, that's probably good advice. But I still like kicking a few men off. I got four egos, I don't care. Any other questions? In which case, getting back to finding the good stuff, there are, I'm sure, a number of other events coming up in Bristol. If nothing else, there's going to be another Fringe happening next month. So has anybody got any announcements? Tom?
Before I plug myself, I just want to sort of say one of our own, Gareth L. Powell, is performing this Thursday at the Lansdowne in Clifton. So it's £5 novel nights. Yeah, really, really good event. Definitely sort of get down to that if you can. There's been, I can't say specifically when, but there's the Sanctum sort of art space, which is running to the 24th, I think. No, sort of, I'm not sure what date. 22nd. It's free. Just wander down there at any time or Saturday morning. Just any time you want. Okay, that's fine. Okay, 8:30, 8 till 9 on 8 till 9 on the 21st. Peter and myself, amongst others, and Joe. Joe will be there as well. Excellent. So there'll be some amazing stories. There'll be three amazing stories and some others. Also, Joe and I and Peter as well be involved in Talking Tales. So a night that I'm hosting just before Christmas, Left Bank in Stokes Croft. So it's 7:30 on the 14th, the Monday. And so that's free. 8 readers, all around 10 minutes in length on a nice Christmas theme. So it should be quite good 2 weeks before Christmas. And I'll let Joe tell you about the 21st, because you never remember the date. It's the 21st.
And the next Fringe.
I knew it was the 21st because it was a week after novel night, so it's the only reason I knew it. Yes, pub night in here next week as normal, which will be awesome. That is the last pub night before Christmas, because the Fringe before Christmas is on the 21st, and we have Simon Kewin and Sarah Ash, so that should be a good one. I think that was it. I am going to write something horrible for Tom for novel nights. And for Talking Tales, there's so many of these things. If you are awake in Bristol at between 8 and 9 on Saturday morning, and you happen to be in Bristol and awake, I'm not going to be awake, but I will be in Bristol. Just saying.
Yeah, I'm doing all sorts of things, but they're nothing to do with writing this month, so I don't really have anything. Pete, have you got any announcements? No? No, we're all kind of winding down for Christmas. Anybody else got any literary events that they want to plug? Jonathan. Oh, yes, of course, I'd completely forgotten about that. That Mr. Jonathan L. Howard is going to be on Ujima Radio on Wednesday, December the 2nd, sometime around noon, I think. Whatever. Yeah, well, the show will go out live on Ujima between noon and 2 p.m., on Wednesday the 2nd of December. It'll also be available through Ujima Radio's Listen Again feature. It will have Jonathan there live in the studio, and fingers crossed and the technology all works, it will also have a pre-recorded interview with the fabulous Emma Newman. So, Carter and Lovecraft and Planetfall all together on the radio in December. And goodness only knows, I've got to do a show on December the 30th. I might just play Christmas music, but no, I'm not going to play the terrible, terrible Christmas songs that Mark Gascoigne of Angry Robot keeps sending me, because they really are terrible, terrible Christmas songs. But I might try and get a few pre-records with other writers that I will stick in on that one as well. Anybody else? No? In which case, I think we're done. Go and drink more beer.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.